Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
We've basically created a society where your quality of life, your social mobility is tied up in your ability to own this huge asset. And even if you do own one, if you're African American, it still doesn't function in the same way that it functions for white people. So there's this embedded inequality within the larger inequality of needing to be a property owner in order to have social mobility. Yep. In our society that really we need to think about.
Hello, and welcome to Why Is This Happening with me, your host, Chris Hayes. Before we get to today's conversation, which if you listen to last week's conversation with Ted Cruz, is pretty different. We just took the car wheel and we just 180 degrees in the opposite direction with today's guest. I'm going to introduce her in a second. But before we get to that, we have still some tickets left for our Los Angeles Live With Pod, which is happening October 21st. It's this amazing theater at the Ace Hotel. Really beautiful. I think it's in downtown LA. Old style kind of theater. You feel like you're going to a Broadway show. It's going to feature me and Adam McKay, who's the Oscar-winning writer and director, who was Will Ferrell's comedy partner, wrote at SNL, started Funny or Die, did Talladega Nights, did Anchorman, and then made this sort of amazing shift into much more serious material. He did The Big Short and Vice, and he's working now on like how to do TV and movies about climate change. He's obsessed with this now. In fact, the last time that I had dinner with him, he kind of like berated me the whole time that I wasn't covering climate enough. I was like, how about you make a movie about climate, dude? So we're going to be talking about that along with an author, a journalist turned author named Omar El Akkad, who wrote this incredible book called American War, which is about a civil war breaking out in the U.S. in the future over climate change and the banning of fossil fuel and its effects. And we're going to have this conversation in Los Angeles Monday, October 21st, about how to represent the moment of climate crisis, the existential hinge point in history we're on, in art and in culture and in movies and film and books. It's going to be an amazing conversation and it's going to be a really fun time and you'll be with a lot of other WithPod heads. So if you're in LA or Southern California or want to travel from anywhere on the West Coast, go to Ticketmaster.com and search for Chris Hayes. Okay, today we've got a great writer and thinker who is writing on a topic that is something I think about a lot. And the way that I tend to think about it is about the phrase inner city. It's funny. Inner city is such a powerful, potent phrase that smuggles in so much conceptual material underneath these two words. Like at one level, it's just like, oh, there's a city. And then the inner part, I guess it's the center of the city. But like when people say inner city, like they don't mean Rockefeller Center, which is where I am right now, even though that's the inner city of New York. We're like near the center of Manhattan. They don't mean the Loop in Chicago. They don't mean like downtown San Francisco or center city Philadelphia. Like we all know what inner city means. Inner city is a code word for poor black people that live in urban environments. Inner city youth. I'm working with inner city youth. We want to revitalize the inner city. Why is that word mean that thing? Why is it the case that we have this race neutral geographic descriptor of a place that actually doesn't mean anything about geography? It just means the race and socioeconomic status of the people. And the reason is because our cities have been, over a long process, American cities are incredibly segregated and have created large concentrated pockets of people of color living in poverty. That has been done through incredible efforts by both public actors, the state, and private actors, the market. Together, they have produced this system. Today's conversation is about how that system got made and a really fascinating moment in the late 1960s, early 70s, when there was some movement to deal with, quote, the problems of the inner city. In the wake of the Watts riots in 1966 and the MLK post-MLK assassination riots in 1968, the signing of the Fair Housing Act, there are programs put into place, new legislation that says, okay, we got to do something. We got to do something about these pockets of segregated poverty in our cities because they're going to explode. And if they explode, that's bad for all of us. So we got to do something. And what today's author's book is about how a program that ostensibly on its face was meant to lift people up out of poverty, to bring them out of segregation, to improve the lives of people in the, quote, inner city, actually ends up doing the opposite. It actually pushes them further into misery. It confines them into ghettos. It draws lines around where they can and can't live. It pushes them into substandard housing. So this is a story about how a government program and the market working together in a moment where people are making, particularly African-American people, are making demands for racial equity, demands for integration, demands for housing quality, where a program comes in and the government and the private sector working together manage to create the exact opposite. They manage to reinscribe all the boundaries that are the boundaries that constitute the inner city. The book is called Race for Profit, How Banks and Real Estate Industry Undermine Black Home Ownership. And the author is Kianga Yamada Taylor, who's a fascinating woman and scholar, writer, and activist. She's written a few different books and articles in the kind of popular press. She worked, as you'll hear in this conversation, for years as an organizer and a housing organizer and tenant advocate before she went to academia. This is her first academic work, and it got longlisted this year for the National Book Award nonfiction category. That's an enormous deal, an enormous deal. I would like kill to have a book on the National Book Award long list. There's only, I think, about a 10 on the long list. And this year they include other WithPod authors, Patrick Radden Keefe, his book about the Troubles, Tressie McMillan Cottom, her book of essays, Thick, both of them have been guests. So Kianga is part of this very illustrious crew. And her book is a fascinating look at the dynamics of policy, race, institutional forces in the market coming together to reinscribe segregation. And it's also an absolutely vital cautionary tale about the danger of bad policy, about the ways in which bad policy and bad politics around those policy and allowing private markets to sort of do what they will with a lot of government money, all the ways in which that could produce truly disastrous outcomes. And that lesson applies way, 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 way more broadly than just housing in the 1970s. Kianga, maybe you can just tell me where you grew up.
So I was born in Buffalo, New York, and then moved to Dallas, Texas with my mom when I think I was around 3. And then went back to Buffalo, where my dad lives, when I was 16.
And your dad is an academic as well, right?
Yeah. We do remarkably very similar things, which is strange because when I was growing up, I think I was probably very resentful of his work because he spent a lot of time working. And not really interested. And it's sort of a funny story. I was in grad school, first year of grad school. I was taking a bus from Chicago to Wisconsin to Madison to look at some archives there. And I was reading Tom Segura's Making of the Urban Crisis. And
it's an amazing history of Detroit in the sort of 1960s, 70s.
And so somewhere in the first or second chapter, I was looking at a footnote. And he had like a paragraph long footnote about all of my dad's work.
That's cool.
It's like, I can no longer avoid this. Yeah. So, yeah.
I mean, it is interesting to me. Like, it's not uncommon across all different professions that people end up doing things that their parents have done. But in academia specifically, like, it's not uncommon to find that. And particularly, I think people, that trajectory I've heard from multiple people, which is I like grow up thinking I don't want to be an academic. And then they find themselves.
I mean, for me, it was a much more circuitous route. I mean, I kind of drifted in and out of school for a long time. There's like a 17-year gap between when I started and got my bachelor's.
Oh, wow. What were you doing?
Just doing politics, organizing, and just living my life. Not very interested in school for probably reasons similar to my dad's obsession with his work. And you know, finally, I was in a job working as a tenant advocate, meaning that I went to court with people to try to stop them from getting evicted. I liked that job. I liked that job a lot, but I didn't like my boss, and I had to figure out how to get out of it, and I didn't have a degree. So I was lucky enough that Northeastern Illinois University, which is like a working class commuter school in Chicago, was less than a mile from my office. So for about 16 months, I took classes from 8 a.m. to 8:50, which left me enough time to get to work by 9 o'clock. And then from 12 to 12:50 for my lunch break, I took another class. And then from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m., I took classes at night.
Wow.
So I was working full time and going to school full time for 16 months.
And that work, the work you were doing then, you said as an organizer or mm-hmm. an advocate, was that in housing equity, housing justice work
yeah.
generally?
Yeah.
It was.
Dealing with tenant issues, but also a lot of Section 8 issues. And it really sparked my interest in segregation, residential segregation. I mean, that is the probably one of the most palpable things about Chicago is the intensity of the segregation. And, you know, it's something that when you're living there, it just becomes a part of the backdrop. And through working with this organization, then I became interested in how it was connected to these really bad living conditions that people I was meeting with were dealing with.
I moved to Chicago right after college, and I'm not from Chicago, from New York City.
Yeah.
Obviously, New York City is also very segregated in certain ways, particularly the education
it's
system,
though.
But it's very different.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget the first time being in the loop at rush hour.
Oh, yes.
And going
when
down,
everyone gets on
exactly,
and then everyone gets off.
And going out
yeah.
of the red line and looking down
yeah.
the platform of the red line, and all the black folks are on one side and all the white and Latino folks
yep.
are on the other side. And it's just the starkest thing you could
yeah.
imagine. And that image is still burned into my head yeah. from the first time I was down there as a New Yorker being like, this
yeah.
is deep, dude. Like, this is like.
No, for me, it was when I lived in New York and then I moved to Chicago, and it was driving in on 94 and going through a black neighborhood that was not a black neighborhood. It was a black enclosure. It went for miles and miles. And then when I first lived in Chicago, I lived near the University of Chicago. I wasn't a student, but I lived in Hyde Park. And, you know, just a few blocks south, this was like the late 90s, the early 2000s, you would not see white people.
It was like there was this sort of like intense racialized propaganda messaging about the border of the Midway.
Oh, yeah.
And not crossing
which is like
it.
A moat. It's like
yeah.
a grass
yeah.
moat. But
yeah.
once you cross it and, you know, if you go a mile in, you just won't see white people. And if you do, you're like, what are you doing here? And it's not quite that stark on the north side, but it was enough that when I moved in that direction, if you saw another black person, it was like, oh, there's another black person.
Right.
You know, it was rare enough to be noticeable. So I was interested in how did this come to be and where did these dynamics come from? Because I had no idea.
So the book, which is called Race for Profit, which congratulations was recently longlisted for the National Book Award
Thank
in
you.
2019, which is an enormous deal. There's like 8 nonfiction books that are on that list. So maybe the way to talk about it, it's your dissertation work, but there's sort of a narrow lens for it and a wide
yeah.
lens, right? So the narrow lens is about a specific program that is inaugurated in the early 1970s around black home ownership and the federal government subsidizing it. But much more broadly, it's about what's the political economy of urbanized segregation?
Mm-hmm.
What role do the different market actors, non-market actors, state actors have in reproducing spatialized segregation, particularly substandard housing for
yes.
African-Americans in that segregated
yeah.
housing? I want to start with like a foundational insight in the book that is at one level, like, I guess it's not obvious. It's clear, but it's profound. And I hadn't thought of it, which is that you sort of say that like segregation is actually constitutive of housing value.
Yes.
Like, and that's the first place to maybe start. Unpack that idea, which is really central in some ways to what you lay out in the book.
Well, this is really about understanding why cities have come to be arranged and organized in the way that they are. You know, I wanted to cut against this idea that segregation is just about individual attitudes and whether or not white people want black neighbors, and to really look at the economic incentives around segregation also as a way to understand why it persists. Even after fair housing is imposed on a national level, which comes after fair housing is fought for on local levels in dozens of places, why does it continue to persist? And what I kept coming back to is because it's profitable. It's profitable in two ways. One, in the idea of the exclusive white neighborhood, that the further white people are away from Black people, the more value their housing becomes, the more valuable their communities become. And it doesn't mean that Black neighborhoods are then invaluable, that there is value in the segregation of Black people. But unlike for white housing, the value doesn't accrue to the owner of the home. In Black housing, the value accrues to the kind of network of private actors who are active in the urban housing market.
So you've got all these intermediaries. There is a lot, you know, when you sum total up the amount of like housing money flowing through the neighborhood of Austin on the west side of Chicago,
yeah,
like there's tens, if not
yes,
hundreds of millions of dollars
right,
flowing around there. And what you're saying is like, there's money to be made there. It's just being made by the intermediaries.
Yeah.
And in the exclusive white neighborhoods, it is essentially being made by the homeowners themselves,
right,
who are sitting on the value.
Right. I mean, the banks are making money too. The
yeah,
real estate industry is making money too. But white people are cut into the deal in ways that Black homeowners during this period, and I would argue it still persists to this day, are either marginalized or cut out of the enormous amounts of money that are being generated. So one is, I wanted to challenge the idea that cities at this time, which are defined by urban crisis, are just these kind of blighted, emptied out places that have no value, but that there is tremendous value, but you have to look for it in different places that are really not about the people who are purchasing property, Black people who are buying homes, who see themselves as investing in some ways, but who are not able to access the capital, the massive amounts of capital that are being generated. In many ways, they're seen as vessels, as ways through which money can flow, but they are not seen in the same way as white homeowners.
And you quote in the book, I mean, a big player in this is the real estate industry,
yeah,
and we'll get to that in a second. But you quote in the book, like, actual textual citations from appraisers in real
mm-hmm,
estate that essentially come down to when appraising a house in a neighborhood, figure out how white it is. And that is, that means it's more valuable.
Well, you think
about,
they
don't quite say that, but
what is value? We can be led to believe that value is this tangible, real thing in the world, but it's not. Value is what one thinks that something is worth. And that is deeply influenced by the social factors that exist in society. So when we talk about the social construction of race or the social construction of gender, we should also be talking about the social construction of value. And so in that case, then understanding the ways that race functions in our society, that we live in a racist society, certainly then influences what is considered to be a value in the society. And so that is certainly mapped on to housing in a very profound way.
You make this argument about these sort of bifurcated markets, right? That segregation is sort of almost a fundamental feature of those markets. And
yeah,
then the program you talk about, you know, the federal government plays an enormous role in building home ownership equity and
yes,
wealth among white people, particularly in the post-war years
yeah,
in which there's a housing shortage, the initiation of a whole variety of subsidies, backstops by the federal government to encourage white home ownership, to build out the suburbs, the interstate highway system, all these
yep,
investments, right? Your book sort of picks up at a moment of increasing claims for equity among racial justice movements.
Right.
Some response yep, by the political system, and sort of an idea of like, okay, well, we should do this for Black people too, who were quite clearly written out of that first deal, often explicitly, right? The idea
right,
behind redlining was the federal government circulated maps of where you couldn't and couldn't lend.
Right.
And so describe the program that you're writing about here and the theory of it, at least in its like best, most charitable interpretation.
So there is the decision that, okay, we have to include Black people, but it's for utterly cynical reasons. It's that there is a saturation of the white housing market, meaning that by 1960, you know, almost 60% of white people are homeowners. So there's always the push for how can we get more, especially as the housing industry, home building, real estate become more and more important in the overall U.S. economy. The driving question is how can we push the bounds of this? But then there are structural problems, which urban renewal and the destruction of millions of units of urban housing creates a problem.
A shortage.
Yeah, it creates a shortage. And some of that problem is dealt with through public housing. So the high-rise public housing that became infamous in the 1960s and 1970s is in many ways built to contain Black populations that have been displaced by urban renewal. But because there is a downward pressure on who is eligible for public housing, in that they want to make this housing of last resort to the poorest people, Black people's incomes are rising during this period. So many of them don't qualify for public housing. So as early as 1954, the FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, begins to tweak its policies to allow for some home ownership on a very small experimental basis for people living in cities who need replacement housing, who don't qualify for public housing. So that's really the beginning of the transition and the FHA's policy. But the FHA is only one part of it. You need banks to lend. So the FHA provides insurance for mortgages for working class people so that in the event if they are to go into foreclosure or default, that the government will step in and pay off those mortgages so that the banks don't suffer a loss.
And so they're, I mean, just so that people understand the sort of basic finance here, they're backstopping the loan.
Yes.
And because they're backstopping the loan is cheaper, which is that they're taking on the risk. And because they're taking on the risk, the actual price of the loan
yes.
comes down. It's a subsidy by the federal government in terms of what you end up paying.
Absolutely. And so this means that you need a lender.
Right.
All right. So
right. They're not lending the money.
They're not backing up the
private bank that's
exactly.
going to lend you the money.
And so even as they're tweaking their policies, their banks are still very reluctant to actually lend money. And it's only that this begins to change in the 1960s with the eruption of urban rebellions across cities. 225 cities experienced uprisings of one sort or another from 1964 through 1968. And so it's in 1967 that a consortium of life insurance companies, 300 of the wealthiest life insurance companies, come together to create a mortgage pool, $1 billion mortgage pool to finance home ownership and also to finance Black businesses and other initiatives that are aimed at redeveloping urban neighborhoods.
So this is part of the kind of cultural political moment in the wake of these urban rebellions, as you call them, in 66 and Watts particularly, and then later after this in 68, obviously, there'll be more of the assassination of MLK, is this sort of, there's the Kerner Commission, there's this kind of like hand-wringing among political elites.
Yeah.
What is to be done? People are clearly very angry. We've got to do something in response to this. And this sort of pool of mortgages kind of grows out of that political cultural moment.
Right. So there's a recognition. There's the threat of violence, which is destabilizing. It's shocking. And there is the changing circumstance in Black life, that Black incomes are rising, that Black people want to be homeowners. Black people want to enjoy the benefits that they see all around them that homeownership is providing. So there's pressure from below. There's pressure from respectable Black people, and there is a growing concern that if we don't actually satisfy this demand around home ownership, not only are we missing out on a new market opportunity, but they might come to our neighborhood. Because this is also when the demands around fair housing, both on a local level and a national level, are picking up steam. And so if you keep Black people locked out of, you know, the places where they live, they might show up in your neighborhood. So maybe we need to take this more seriously.
And in fact, it's during this period that MLK has a march in Chicago for fair housing.
Yes.
through a segregated white neighborhood where a brick is hurled at him. He later comments that those people could teach the folks in Mississippi
yes.
how to hate. And again, to go back to the Chicago, like it's these northern cities with large Black populations produced by the Great Migration are now on this frontline question of like, we mean it. Right.
Right?
I mean,
right.
Some sort of integration, some sort of housing equity and fairness here. We're not going to just allow you to lock us in ghettos.
And that's what's so interesting, because people usually, you know, think about these rebellions as nationalists, as exclusive, as trying to separate from the nation, when in fact, what they are demands for inclusion. The U.S. is projecting itself as the affluent society, and Black people's children are being mauled to death by rats in urban neighborhoods. And so people want to be included into this affluence, and home ownership, as we know, is a central pillar of that. And so the culmination of these different pressures leads the federal government in 1968 to pass this legislation, the Housing and Urban Development Act of that year, that includes at its center, really, a low-income home ownership program is one element of it, but it breathes new life into these earlier efforts that had been abandoned because they couldn't actually find lenders to participate. And now there's a kind of blanket mortgage insurance and guarantees that brings these other programs to life as well. So they're actually five or six different kinds of home ownership programs for low income, but also poor people, people who are on welfare, to dramatically expand the number of homeowners. And in some of their, the eyes of the legislators, the what we might call stakeholders in cities, because Nixon cynically commented about homeownership in cities that, well, if they own their own homes, then they won't burn the cities down. Right. So there's a lot of different motivations, but the final product is the creation of these programs in 68.
Describe what the programs start doing.
So the most well-known of them is Section 235 of the 68 Housing Act. And what that does is basically say that for $200 down and for 20% of your income, not the value of the house, 20% of your income, you can be a homeowner. And, you know, that makes it incredibly easy for thousands of people to partake in the program. And because the 20% is attached to income and not the value of the house, it also creates an incentive for kind of nefarious activity among real estate speculators to flip very poorly conditioned housing very quickly, in some cases to collude with FHA appraisers who for a bribe of, you know, between $100 and $300 will inflate the value of the house, because it doesn't really matter to the homeowner because their payment is based on their monthly income. So it's really those two factors open up the opportunity to own a home for thousands of people who are targeted by these programs.
And I want to talk about what the experience was like for those homeowners right after we take this quick break.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win. Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
At one level, right, when you're looking at this, you're thinking, okay, well, there's a certain kind of, like, equitable logic here.
Mm-hmm.
It is certainly the case the federal government massively subsidized the entire mortgage market and post-war housing construction boom for white families.
Yeah.
A. B, it is also the case that that was a very successful wealth-generating enterprise. Like, it really did lower the cost of mortgages, massively boost white home ownership, and massively boost the amount of equity, home equity, and wealth in white families.
Yes, this is why Black people want
in. Right. So you exactly. So for those reasons, you could look at this program and say, okay, we're talking equity now.
Totally different.
We're going to come in and we're going to do something similar. We're going to backstop these loans. In fact, we're going to do something even more important. We're actually going to cap it so that, like, you don't have to have a lot of income. Right. If you're on welfare, you can buy a home. But it doesn't produce the same.
So many differences. In the post-war period, when the initial federal program was underway. These were new houses. These were newly built houses in the suburbs. Interest rates were at historic lows during this period of time.
Right.
And so those, you know, two conditions made a big difference. So what is happening in the urban market? The housing is incredibly old. In some places like St. Louis, the houses in Black neighborhoods are between 70 and 80 years old.
And untouched, largely.
Yeah. Interest rates are on the rise in the late 1960s because of the Vietnam War, because of global markets and the instability of the American dollar. Interest rates are going up to historic highs at that particular point in time. And so this becomes a very expensive venture. And, you know, home ownership is difficult under good circumstances because it's unpredictable.
It sure is.
You never know if, you know, you're going to have to get a hole in the roof,
yeah,
you know, fixed, if a pipe in the basement bursts.
The costs are really unpredictable.
Yes.
And it can be catastrophic, particularly if you're operating in a razor-thin margin.
And so if you're on a fixed income,
it's
even more complicated. And so part of the issue that dated back to the consortium of life insurance companies was with their program, your ability to get a loan was contingent on the property being in what they described as an area that would ordinarily be redlined, which meant the ghetto. And so that logic was still applied under these new circumstances, which essentially meant that African Americans were continuing to be segregated. And so not only, you know, does that raise moral questions and moral dilemmas, but what does it do to the housing market? It means that as Black people continue to be a captured market, it drove the price up and the quality of the housing down. It dramatically limited their ability to function, to be mobile within the housing market.
Right, because they're already constrained sort of socially by segregation,
yeah,
right? The fact that all these sometimes legal but not always legal sort of institutional arrangements, including the realtors themselves, right, are sort of maintaining this bifurcated market.
Yeah.
Now, legally, they're pegged into these redlined areas, again, as a kind of like some sort of egalitarian racial liberalism, because that's who the program is targeted to apply to, but ends up having the perverse effect of further reinscribing the bifurcated market. And then there's all these subsidy money flowing through, but there's not actually sufficient supply of good housing.
Exactly.
So now you're just like, you've set up the conditions for, you call it in the book, predatory inclusion.
Right.
What happens? Like, give us examples of what it ends up looking like at the ground level.
So predatory inclusion is really a way of understanding how the previous conditions of segregation that helped to erode the quality of housing in urban areas also then becomes the basis upon declaring those neighborhoods what we would call today as subprime. And so the subprime nature of these neighborhoods then legitimizes banks' efforts to charge more, to have a different set of criteria, to really make African Americans' engagement with lending more expensive. And so it's really a way of trying to understand the continuities between the previous period of racist exclusion and how that really creates new vulnerabilities for Black people to be included, but on different and still exploitative terms.
Right, because the system is now set up where, like, there's money to be made essentially by finding an applicable borrower.
Right.
In many cases, a Black woman with children on public aid. Putting her in totally substandard housing, housing that was worthless before because it was so substandard. So it was essentially zombie housing, right?
Right?
It's $0 sitting on a ledger. But now you could perform this magic trick of exploiting the subsidy by taking some woman, putting her in there. She is now a homeowner. And now all of a sudden there's value up that's grown up around this substandard housing that you are essentially getting from the federal government.
So this is the scandalous aspect of this. Speculators rush into what has been previously an abandoned market, and they start to buy up not just substandard. In many cases, these houses had been legally condemned.
Literally condemned.
Condemned, unfit for human habitation. And that could be another show about Philly. There are literally hundreds of apartments, houses in the city of Philadelphia that are designated unfit for human habitation that thousands of people live in. And so the speculators come in, they do a cosmetic paint job, they find someone, a black woman who wants to get out of public housing, who is lured by the promise of becoming a homeowner, who agrees to purchase the home, who is able to get a loan through these new low-income homeownership programs. And then within a matter of weeks and months, the house begins to fall apart around them. And, you know, with no kind of help or assistance, because these are all your problems
right now. You own this condemned house.
Then they walk away. And the banks don't care because the federal government has guaranteed the loan. The realtor has made their commission.
And they're making a commission on the sale price,
yes,
too.
So they're exactly
they could do quite well. You're finding someone who has very low, like, again, the payments of the mortgage are capped to income.
Right.
But the commission the realtor is getting is on the sale price.
Right. Exactly. And the other part of the scandal was that FHA appraisers, many of whom were part-time real estate agents working in the same market that they are appraising, are taking bribes, are taking kickbacks to inflate the value, because all these homes, in order to qualify for the loan, have to be inspected. And so an actual official has to sign off on the value. And so that was part of the deal. Together, these stories begin to mount. And so by the early 1970s, certainly by 1972, the scandals are front page news in every major city in the United States. 60 Minutes does two exposés on HUD and the homeownership programs, one in 1971, another in 1975. The Chicago Tribune wins a Pulitzer Prize in 1975 for its coverage of the HUD scandals in that city. The Philadelphia Inquirer was a finalist for the Pulitzer for its coverage in Philadelphia. And it was really black homeowners in Philly that reported these conditions to their congressman, who then was very quick to summon a hearing. And so some of that was politics. Some of that was Democrats who had unceremoniously been removed from the presidency and had lost control of the program, because this was a Johnson program that was now under the auspices of Nixon. And so some of that was politics that, you know, look at how the Republicans are mismanaging.
Right. This is what happens when you elect a Republican to run a fair housing program.
But it very quickly grew into much more of that, because the scandals kept expanding wider and wider and wider.
And you write in the book how, in some ways, the scandals, and I think there's a really interesting parallel to subprime crisis, which we can talk about, has all the ready-made ingredients for kind of a reactionary narrative.
Yeah.
In which the African-American homeowners, who are sort of the victims of the scam.
Right.
They are the victims of the predatory inclusion set up by the incentive structure, by the actual system that's set up, become the sort of moral lesson for white America about what happens if you try to take these people and make them homeowners.
Right. The focus almost immediately shifts to the program participants, and the conditions of the house are those because black women don't actually know how to keep a clean house, you know, which of course is richly ironic, because many of these congressmen had black women cleaning their own homes. And so
literally going home to that after their speeches.
Yeah. And so black women become the face of the scandal as unsophisticated buyers, that they don't know enough. They don't understand enough about home maintenance. So there's HUD creates a pamphlet to show women in public housing and in these home ownership programs how to clean house properly. It's like a 10-page illustrated pamphlet on how to sweep a floor, how to wipe off a countertop, how to clean your oven. This becomes a central part of the story. And the role of the banks, the role of the real estate industry kind of began to fade into the background. And there is a much more narrow focus on the perceived problems of the people who are participating in the program is maybe the root of the issue. And that this becomes a new example of how government can go too far. This is kind of like a social engineering experiment gone crazy, where you know, one congressman from Ohio says you can't build a middle-class program in the ghetto. And there's a sense that the federal government is trying to fit square pegs into round holes.
I did not realize until I read your book what a story it was at the time. Yeah. And also how it is really similar to me in the arguments that many on the right made about the financial crisis, right? That the problem with the financial crisis wasn't banks. It wasn't collateralized debt obligations.
It's the Community Reinvestment Act.
Yes, right. It was the Community Reinvestment Act, and it was too many loans basically to black people.
Yeah.
Like the problem was black people brought down the system.
Right. Because they wanted too much house.
Because they wanted too much house and because our bleeding heart government lent them, like subsidized too many loans to them.
Yeah. They can't live within their means, you know, and they need to not every home ownership isn't for everyone, especially these people. Look at what they did to public housing. And so George Romney, everyone's beloved liberal Republican, the last among them, you know, is one of the key actors who participates in making these associations, kind of collapsing the problems with public housing in with the black women who are homeowners. And he feeling particularly scrutinized because of the ongoing congressional investigations, in many ways is one of the most vitriolic in talking about the housekeeping skills of black women and the notion that the problems in these programs are just another example of how people want something for nothing.
Right. To me, the ideological project here, right, is that you have a policy that is explicitly from the beginning a public-private partnership.
Yeah.
There's private market actors which are acknowledged and part of it, collaborating with public government actors to create a kind of like subsidized market. Mm-hmm. And there's sort of two ideological directions to attack that from. Mm-hmm. The right-wing libertarian direction, which is the same one that we've seen in the 2007 subprime crisis and the financial crisis, is this is what happens when you social engineer in a market, when you create these incentives, when you create these backstops and government subsidies.
Yeah.
You're trying to make the argument kind of from the other side.
Yeah. I mean, I think with that argument, part of the problem is that HUD makes no effort to enforce its own rules, makes no effort to enforce the Fair Housing Act, makes no effort to enforce anything having to do with civil rights. And so this is part of the problem.
Right. The original conditions of segregation are not eroded by the passage of the 1968 Act.
Right. So the law has to be enforced. And so it's the enforcement capacity is left to HUD. It relies on appropriations to be able to finance that. And so in 1969, gets $6 million, $5 million of which is dedicated to staffing. And that leaves $1 million and 120 people to investigate all claims of discrimination in housing in the United States. And so that's part of the problem with that. On the other end, I mean, for me, it's very basic that in real estate, the objective is to make money. That's what speculation is about. That's what the real estate game is about. It's about making money. That is very different from defending or protecting the public's welfare and the public's interest. And these clash wildly in these home ownership programs. I mean, you could say that about public-private partnerships in any realm where you're talking about the need to deliver public services in general. But there is something particular to the real estate industry whose entire history is bound up with the racial exclusion of black people and the profiteering from racism, to then empower that sector with the authority and legitimacy of the state is a recipe for disaster. I mean, there is a reason why African-American organizations, community groups have always called for a greater role of the state because of the ways that racism and discrimination run rampant and unchecked in the private sector. So there was no regulatory impositions placed on the private sector in these different programs. And part of it has to do with the nature of the programs themselves, which is when you're in partnership, it makes it difficult to then be the police of the same relationships, especially
when we're partnering on running this thing in the Chicago South Side or West Side.
Yeah.
We're not also going to be the cop that sort of
But that's the logic of the program, that the state can somehow still fulfill its regulatory responsibilities. And it didn't happen. And when you consider that the U.S. government was in the process of ending its managing creating public housing, housing that it was responsible for, and saying, no, we are going to let the private sector produce the housing. We will subsidize the private sector so that it distributes the housing, but the state is extracting itself from this role. That makes regulating even more complicated. And the inability to monitor, and even throughout the process of the early 70s, where you have hearing after hearing that is uncovering malfeasance after malfeasance, the dependent relationship meant that there was nothing that could be done, that people literally just watched these programs devolve. That created an opening for Nixon to use the scandals as a way to completely shut down the subsidized housing programs across the board in 1973. Nixon essentially imposes a moratorium on all subsidized housing. So not just the home ownership programs, but the moratorium included all subsidized housing in the United States until an audit and an investigation was completed to learn more about the programs, which lasted for about 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
What do you see as the lesson here about the kind of political market and institutional structures of segregation and how they can or cannot be overcome?
Well, for me, there were big questions that were raised. And it's not just about this or that public policy, but there's a question about the role of home ownership in general right. in our society, and that we've basically created a society where your quality of life, your social mobility is tied up in your ability to own this huge asset. And even if you do own one, if you're African American, it still doesn't function in the same way that it functions for white people. So there's this embedded inequality within the larger inequality of needing to be a property owner in order to have social mobility yep. in our society that really we need to think about.
It's also crazy how much those incentives affect people's behavior. Like
this is why you have the crazy white mobs.
Right.
It's because of your home values do matter.
I even now, like, so I have a mortgage on a home in New York. We own a home in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
We're very lucky to be able to afford that. And I even now, I will see reporting in the paper, and this has actually been the case in the last few years, that home values in New York are down. The public policy part of me is like, good.
Right, right.
It's too expensive to live in New York.
Right.
We need housing to come down. I would love for it to drop year over right. year for several years in a row so that more, but the homeowner part of me is like, oh, that's not great.
Yeah. No, this is
and like that's
we've
exactly
organized our society where you need, you know, people look at the house to finance their retirement, to send their kids to school, to weather, you know, a healthcare emergency or crisis. This is crazy. This is crazy. And so we have to detach these things that create social mobility, that create a decent quality of life, from your ability to own a home for white people. For black people, you can own a home and it still doesn't function
right.
in that same way. So for me, this raised much bigger systemic questions than just the constant, well, we just need to find ways to, you know, create more openings for black people to become homeowners, never addressing the fact that, well, that number did increase and yet the racial wealth gap never goes away because housing for black people is valued differently
right.
than
so,
it is for white people.
Right. So that's the paradox at the heart of it, which is that if you look at from a metric standpoint, this was particularly true up to 2007, which is that like black home ownership rates increasing year after year, but the racial wealth gap not
yeah.
getting smaller because
yeah.
clearly one is not solving the other
right.
precisely because of the bifurcated market that you talk
right.
about in the book.
And so the constant droning on that is found in, you know, every presidential candidates, you know, our solution for housing, we need more black homeowners, doesn't deal with this basic inequity that is embedded in the housing market because of the way that race shapes value in the United States.
I guess I'm curious about where you think we are in this ideological moment, particularly on the left, where I think there is a turn more than I've ever seen in the time that I've covered politics away from, for lack of a better word, neoliberal interventions
sure.
that have to do with the kinds of market incentive measures that we see in this program that you document and more broad, universal, publicly provisioned goods.
Oh, yeah. I think that the fact that Sanders in 2016 got 13 million votes, and the fact that as underreported that as it is, that he's a leading contender for the Democratic Party's nomination this late in the game and, you know, for the 2020 race, speaks to the ways that American capitalism is not working for tens of millions of people in this country. And these are supposed to be the good times. It's, you know, 10 years out
That's
from the crisis.
Wild.
There's, you know, 3% growth. There's a historic low unemployment.
Historic
and who cares?
Black unemployment.
Historic
as the
low.
Likes to tell everyone.
That's right. It's 5%. And who cares? Because everyone is broke. Everyone is just walking around with this, you know, debt tumor. And it cuts into any sense that, you know, you're actually able to get ahead. You know, 17% of people are paying 51% of their income for rent. There's another, you know, 30% that are paying, you know, more than 30% of their rent. So it means most people are paying more for rent than is supposed to be,
right,
you know, healthy for their own economic lives. And so these are the good times. And, you know, people are living check to check, stressed out. And that has created an opening to think about a different way to perhaps not completely organize our society, but we're probably on the road to thinking that way.
You really think so?
Oh, yeah. I think this isn't, it's not working. It's not working. And I think for millions of people, whether it's healthcare, whether it's student loan debt, and the idea that you will never be able to get ahead, you know, so you assume all this debt. They tell you go to college, you know, you assume all this debt. You can't find a job. For most people, you can't find a job that will actually allow you to pay it back. So you just spend your life paying off bills and working long hours and not being able to afford the rent because
the
rent's
too damn high.
It's called
the American dream.
I know. America. I know. It's turned into a nightmare, as Malcolm X said. And not just for Black people, but for millions of people. White people, working class white people,
sure, yeah.
Life expectancy has gone in reverse. This does not happen, in the developed world. And it's driven by alcoholism, opioid addiction, and suicide. And so what is that? Greatest country in the history of humanity. American exceptionalism. Yes, exceptionally depraved and cruel. And that's the reality for millions of people in this country. That's why everybody's on drugs. That's why everybody's looking at their phone. Because we live completely alienated lives, and it's driven by capitalism.
What am I going to say after that? Kianga Yamada-Taylor is an assistant professor of African American Studies at Princeton. Her book, A Race for Profit, How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership, is out now. It was also on the long list for the 2019 National Book Awards for Nonfiction, which is a very big deal. It's really excellent, as you can tell from the conversation. I suggest you pick it up. Thank you, Kianga.
Thanks, Chris.
Once again, my great thanks to Kianga Yamada-Taylor. The book is called Race for Profit, How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Home Ownership. Also, if you like that conversation, there's a few other conversations you can listen to. Our conversation with Tressie McMillan-Cottom on her book, Thick. A great conversation about our real estate obsession and how housing and home ownership got built in the U.S. in the post-war period with Giorgio Angelini, and Patrick Radden-Keefe's discussion of Ghosts of the Dirty War, since Patrick also is on the long list of the National Book Award. I'm not on that list, just in case you're wondering. No, I'm not. I'm not there. But maybe I could interview myself and get myself on the list. We got a lot of great feedback from you guys, actually. Well, how do I say this? We got a lot of feedback about the Ted Cruz interview. It did really run the gamut. You guys downloaded and listened to it, which was awesome. I love seeing all the feedback. I think, you know, again, we're always kind of trying to do new things and take different risks here and talk to different people. And I thought it was in certain moments really substantive and fascinating and illuminating, and other moments really maddening. But that's just the nature of these kinds of discussions. And I think we'll do them again. That's not the last time we do that, for sure. It will also not be an every week thing. And finally, but perhaps most importantly, if you're in L.A., don't forget to buy tickets to our live show on sale now. It's October 21st at the Theater at the Ace Hotel. You can go to Ticketmaster.com and search Chris Hayes. buy one for your friend, buy a few for your friends, and come out, and I can't wait to see you. Why Is This Happening is presented by MSNBC and NBC News, produced by the All In team, and features music by Eddie Cooper. You can see more of our work, including links to things we mentioned here, by going to nbcnews.com/whyisthishappening.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-hosts cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.